Hey kids, do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling too. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Myself and Chris Novembrino kind of doing a lazy river of wrestling criticism, going through the news and whatever happened in stateside television wrestling. And also, you know what? Sometimes we just like to watch old stuff and talk about that too. Love for you to give us a listen if you haven't already. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back to another special episode of The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. I'm your host, Tyler Fornes, and with me, as always, Fred Moreland. How are you, Fred?
Doing well. How are you, Tyler?
Well, as you can tell with the dog in the background, we're doing great here out in Minnesota.
The perfect audio, we always do.
Yeah, hey, everybody loves the doggos.
And we have a very special guest today from the Wrestling Observer newsletter and basically legendary Dave Meltzer. Dave, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Fred's helped me out a lot, so I was very happy to do the show with him.
We really appreciate having you on. We're going to do a little mailbag today, but there is one thing I want to ask you. First of all, since it just happened last night, and The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy is it's our podcast, and we primarily focus on AEW, so I feel obliged to ask you about the Kevin Sullivan move last night. It came out that Kevin Sullivan, who had been with the company basically since the beginning, was fired by AEW at the decision of Mike Mansoury, who came in from WWE earlier this year. There's a report, and you talked about this on Observer Radio overnight, that there's people that are unhappy about that backstage in AEW. A big part of that is just the visuals of a former WWE guy firing a day one AEW guy. What do you think about this move in general? And also, what do you think about the atmosphere backstage in AEW and just how things are going there? Is it generally an unhappy locker room? Is it a small group? Like, what do you think right now?
As far as like Kevin Sullivan, most people thought he did really good work. He worked really hard. I was surprised, at it. It was what it was. I know some people were unhappy Tony Khan didn't step in, and thought that Kevin should have stayed. As far as like the background and everything, it's kind of varies, it's like, it's interesting because a lot of there's a prevailing perception that AEW is doing poorly. In some categories, if you look at house show advances, they are. A lot of the advances other than like London and Nassau, but,
tonight is looking awful. I believe it's Montreal. Their collision taping tonight is.
Well, we knew Montreal wasn't going to do that, but they may do okay with the walk up and the Wednesday. You're doing two straight shows in the market, and the Wednesday show will do well by current standards. But I would have liked, debut in a hot wrestling market like Montreal. I think if it was like a year, 18 months ago, you'd be looking at, I got to think 8,000 plus, and they're obviously not going to come close to that.
No,
so
not even half that.
Well, tonight they won't. They'll do better than half that tomorrow. But part of it is collision's a hard sell in Canada because they don't even get it on television there.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, but aside from that, revenue wise, the company's had incredible growth, and pay per view is good, and the ratings are, they're up and down. The weekend ratings haven't been particularly good, although this week was up, and the Wednesday ratings are always very good. So it's, but there's, I think that the nature of what's going on there is there's so many good wrestlers there, and there is only a limited amount of television time. And so many people are just kind of on the shelf. And when that happens, you're going to have unhappy people. When they signed that many people, it's inherent. Everything could be going great, and you're going to have unhappy people, just like you had in WWE You know, guys that weren't getting, you know, there's going to be guys that don't get a lot of TV time and don't get a lot of angle time, and they're going to be unhappy because it's a different generation of guys. You know, the old generation would just be, I'm making free money, I'm not having to work. This generation really wants to be a good wrestler. And the fact that you're making your money is the same either way is doesn't matter as much as you want. You know, you want to be creative and you want a good career and you want a legacy. And, you know, it's really frustrating because there's, I don't know that anyone is 100% happy with their lot in any company, but there's a lot of guys that are, you know, kind of sitting on the bench, and women too, where you go like, how come we haven't seen this? And how come we, you know, and it's, those are valid questions. And it's, you know, there's no way with a roster that big that you can service that many people. That's just, that's just the reality of it.
Yeah, I would agree completely. And I kind of want to shift focus here, Dave, for a second as we get the squeaky toy in the background to wrestling media. And you have been involved in wrestling media for the better part of the last five decades. But it, being involved in sports media myself with USA Today, I kind of see some flaws. And I wanted your take on how wrestling media has evolved, or I guess in this fact devolved into the kind of the spaces now where you have a few people who practice regular journalistic integrity, and then those who are doing the exact opposite, whether it be both like malicious or just, you're just allowing fans in the room and that's not really helping anybody. I kind of wanted your opinion on what the landscape looks like, maybe how we can fix it and how we got here.
I don't know how to fix it. It's just, I think it evolved because there was no such thing and there's no barriers to entry. And, you know, it's funny because when I was doing MMA, the people in real sports thought, oh, you know, like so many of these MMA guys are just fans. They're not real sports writers. And then when you go to wrestling, it's even accentuated even more. I mean, there's some, but how many have, you know, legitimate backgrounds? And a lot of it is just, I mean, I find it really sad because so much is just like clickbait for headlines and things like that. And, you know, and there's also an evolving change in the audience. The audience wants their whole story in, you know, 300 words. And in some stories, you don't even need 300 words. And in other stories, you need 3,000 words. And I don't think people, I mean, there's people who have the patience for it, but a lot of people don't. And, you know, it's like everything that's rumored anywhere becomes news immediately, whether true or not, which is a really tough situation for sure. You know, I mean, like, as far as like checking and stuff, you know, but, you know, it is what it is. But I mean, like, when I see, you know, media scrums and everything like that, when it comes to, you know, both AEW and WWE, there are obviously very real reporters and very real questions. And they're usually in the minority, you know, I mean, sometimes it's just, it's stuff where it's like, you know, like it's stuff that you would never see at an NFL game, put it that way. But some, I mean, there are some very, very good people in this. Some very, very smart people who do understand their role and understand the business. And then there's a lot of people who, I like this, I don't like this, why are you doing this? Or just, you know, trying, you know, whatever, you know, it varies. Like, you can't blanket everyone, you know, that would be completely wrong. But is it as good as in other sports? And the answer would be no, it's not.
Kind of off of that, Dave, because I think the media scrums are a really interesting angle of this, because it's not just reporting news. I mean, I do a lot of aggregating myself. I do a little bit of news reporting here and there, but a lot of my job is more analysis based. Do you think the scrums have been a net positive, or have they actually become a negative? Because the concept of scrums is great. You want media access. You want to be able to ask like tough questions, but we're seeing in a lot of these scrums that even with the good people in the room, as you kind of say, the ones that are smart, the ones that are journalists and practice that, we're not getting as much of that element out of it that we might normally be able to in, like you said, other sports. Do you do you still view these scrums as a net positive for the business and industry?
They're a positive, you know, because you do get some stuff. I think WWE, you know, for the most part, and we'll see how this evolves, but what I have seen, you know, from WWE is that, you know, they want to do 100% storyline. And once you're doing that, then it's not, you know, and they're not really very open with, they're not really that open. You know, I mean, like in some cases they are, but really, really not that much compared to anything else. AEW, it's completely up to, you know, kind of, you know, each individual is different. You know, like if you have Bryan Danielson out there, you're going to get a lot of good stuff. If you have Tony Khan out there, you're going to get very, very detailed, long answers. And if you, you know, listen to everything, you can get a whole lot out of it. But you also have to have the right questions to be asked. If not, you know, you're not going to get anything valid if the questions are bad. So it depends on the questions, and it depends on who the person is, you know, and how open they want to be. A lot of the storyline stuff, it's kind of, you know, it's like, it's wrestling's always had that thing. It's like, do you answer in storyline? And I mean, and even with AEW, you know, I mean, Tony Khan will answer some questions in storyline, and then he will answer some questions, you know, on business as much as he can. And then sometimes he'll just not answer, you know, because he doesn't want to talk about those things. And, but it's, he's never, making fun of you for asking questions. I've seen, you know, Paul Levesque, like, somebody asks a serious question and he tries to like turn it into a joke. So it's kind of like, you know, we only want the fawning questions. And so, but I mean, it's not always, I mean, like on the, when Paul did the scrums, I mean, I thought those were a positive, not all, the, you know, it's like you had a lot of questions that weren't the best, but when you had a good question, he acknowledged it on the phone scrums. The live ones I've seen are, especially because they're streamed on Peacock and everything like that, they're way more of an entertainment storyline aspect than a real scrum. And so those to me are, they're storyline, you know, it's fine. And it's fine. You know, it's, there's nothing wrong with that, but I don't consider that real, you know, I mean, encouraging real journalism either.
Kind of segueing into the mailbag part, I'm going to start with a question that kind of came up when I was talking with my wife. She is a physician who specializes in infectious diseases, and it was interesting to watch the Hangman Page Swerve Strickland match with her, with all the blood. She had some opinions, but yeah. She wanted me to ask you about AEW's wellness policy, and in two specific ways. One, do you know if anyone's actually been suspended for violating it in terms of, you know, substances that they shouldn't be taking? Or what's their testing like? And does it?
I don't believe AEW tests. So really? If you don't test, you're not going to be suspended.
Catch anyone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know that anyone is testing regularly these days. I mean,
yeah, because when was the last WWE suspension? Was that Roman Reigns in like 2019?
It's been years, and you know, it's like when you have 200 people on the roster and 100 on the main roster in this business, you know, you know, even if most of them are going to be clean and most of them are, and everything, you're never going to get 100%. So when you're having no suspensions, that's kind of telling me that, you know, you're, I don't know, there's something, it ain't like, put it this way. With UFC, the penalties are much, much, much higher. And we hear about guys failing left and right.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, it's not like it's a 6-week suspension. With UFC, it's like you're talking 6 months, you're talking 2 years in some cases for some things. And even then, you still get people who fail. And it's and so that's telling me, you know, and there's more pressure. I mean, like with UFC, there's certainly there's different pressures, you know, whether it's pro wrestling or MMA, as far as drug use goes. I mean, with pro wrestling, because of, you know, you have to, you know, it's a lot more matches and there's a different style of physicality. It's not the scariness of getting beat up, but there's way, way, way more emphasis on how your body looks when you're a pro wrestler than when you're a fighter. If you're a good fighter, and you know, you don't have a good body, you're still a good fighter. If you're a great pro wrestler and you don't have a good body, it's really very difficult to get a job with WWE. Not impossible, but still, it's still a you know, and for women, and there's always going to be outliers, don't get me wrong, but with women, it's even harder than with guys. You know, yeah. I mean, they're judged way more on their looks.
What was the gymnastics book, by the way, that you had mentioned previously on one of your shows? Like Little Pretty Boxes or something like that?
The gymnastics book from years and years ago. Yeah. Pretty Packages or something. Yeah.
I need to read that. But yeah, my second question, because, part of this was I was reading your 2014 Observer book last night, and I got to the chapter about premature deaths in wrestling and how much of a role, like, performance-enhancing drugs like steroids played a role in those early deaths. And, I'm concerned about that kind of coming back to some degree between painkillers and steroids, or HGH and that kind of stuff, which I know isn't as dangerous as steroids, but, if it's not enforced, I'm afraid we're going to get some.
HGH in any wrestling company, there's carte blanche to that.
Because right.
They're not testing for that. And, some people argue that, look, in Hollywood, they don't either. And wrestling is not a sport. And there's a validity to that, but there's also competition. But the same competition does exist in Hollywood. But right. the difference is wrestling historically, and not this generation. This generation is much different. But wrestling historically, one of the people go, well, why do you do this? And it's like, I lived through this, and I know that unchecked, and maybe it's a generational change. But we had a generation that was a disaster when it came to people's health and mm-hmm. many, many, many deaths. And because the drug situation was unchecked, that was a key reason, because the death rate went down in companies that were doing real testing markedly. But now the reality is we're not having the young deaths. So it's not, we could again, but we're not having it. So, again, the schedule is easier. The demands are different. The demands are more to be light and quick. And because of that, being, 300 pounds is not to your advantage at all today. In fact, every company pretty much, when they get those big football lineman guys, in WWE, when they recruit them, they try to get them down in weight a lot. They're not going in there and going like, hey, we want you to look like Hulk Hogan. What I mean? Whereas another generation, it was all based on looking like Hulk Hogan or looking like you can stand next to Hulk Hogan, which is a pretty tough thing to do, they weren't normal people, even for genetically gifted big people, standing next to Hulk Hogan and not looking ridiculous was difficult.
Yeah. And just playing, going off of the medical aspect of things too, do you know if AEW, since they allowed late jobs, do you know if they do any testing for HIV, hepatitis B, C?
I do not know that, but I sure hope so.
I hope so too. Just something that Nicole and I have talked about before. So certainly hope they're doing it on a regular basis too.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm not a big fan of the blood at all, especially the amount of it. But they're going to do it. It's been part of their MO of being different, and they do have to be different. I think they go overboard with it sometimes. And I don't know if that's a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing for some of the audience, and it's not a good thing for a lot of the audience too. I've watched a lot of, I think that heavy, heavy blood wrestling limits your audience. They do heavy, heavy blood wrestling, but at the same time, no blood wrestling. You want to do something different from the market leader. You have to be different. And that's one of the ways that they're going about being different.
Tyler.
Dave, I think one of the really interesting things about the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame is that every candidate is so different. You can have a lot of arguments about different candidates based on the three criteria you've laid out. And one of our listeners, Matt, has a question about Super Dragon. And I think his case is fascinating, and I'm not quite sure how good it is right now, but I think it could grow over the course of the next several years because of PWG's influence on modern day wrestling. And you can look at early day NXT when it was essentially PWG style and how that's evolved, and you can contribute that to a lot of AEW success. Where do you sit with Super Dragon as far as an influence case in professional wrestling? Because, I mean, he's a decent enough worker, but I don't think that's really going to contribute.
No, he's not going to. He's not getting in as a wrestler.
No.
As a promoter, that's an interesting one because, you know, very few promoters get in and should get in. And he was not what you would call, you know, he never ran a full-time territory or anything like that. But PWG was special. You know, I mean, again, like, I know from wrestlers from Japan in particular that they, that was their dream is PWG because it opens up the rest of the United States and things like that. And PWG has been an incredibly influential promotion. So it's an interesting person. I'd never really, nobody ever really brought him up to me before.
I think I've actually suggested him to you before, Dave. So how dare you? Just kidding. But yeah, I think there's a case there. I don't know if I would vote for him, but I actually think that he's underrated in terms of historical importance just because of.
I would agree with that. I would agree. Yeah. PWG itself is very underrated as far as historical importance. I think that there's, you know, it's funny too, because I think that there's PWG has a very, very unwarranted negative stigma among some people who have never actually been and probably never even watched it because of the idea of something that it's that are attributed to it that, you know, and nothing, you know, nobody's ever perfect or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But PWG has been an incredible positive to me, to wrestling for me, because, you know, so much of what I learned about wrestling that was valid at one point, I went to PWG, saw the opposite and go, oh, this is never going to work. And it does. And then it's kind of like, well, I guess you got to reevaluate wrestling, you know, modern days. And a lot of people don't want to do that. I know, like one time I was at a PWG show, the crowd was going crazy. It was an awesome show. And some older guy who was, you know, from the 70s, 80s, you know, just goes, none of these matches were any good. And I go, the crowd's going nuts for every one of them. And it's like, it's not how I was taught, you know? And it's like, yeah, I know. It's not how I was taught either. But if it works, and I mean, like, look, their business was good. They were selling at every show. The talent, you know, they had a great eye for talent. How much talent, when you look through there, ended up going places, you know, whether it's Japan or WWE or AEW and, you know, now and TNA later and, you know, Ring of Honor and all that. Yeah. But I mean, you could make a big, you know, you could make a case also of the influence of Ring of Honor, you know, I mean, because, and Ring of Honor was a higher profile company than PWG. PWG was a more cult thing. I mean, people flew from all over the country to go to those shows, but they were only a couple shows a year, so you could do that. You know, Ring of Honor, they were doing shows every weekend, and you know, Ring of Honor opened a lot of room too.
We have another question from Alan Farrell, which I thought was really good. He asked you, in the mid-90s, which of these did you feel had most staying power in terms of their style in Japan? Shoot style, so like Rings, Pancras, UWFI, Lucharesu, so Michinoku Pro and Hamada UWF, and hardcore wrestling like FMW and IWA. And also in 2023, which style do you think ended up having the biggest impact both in Japan and worldwide?
Man, that's a tough one. I mean, like, shoot style doesn't even hardly exist anymore, so it wouldn't be that. You know, deathmatch style does exist, but I think that the that Dragon Gate thing is more influential on mainstream wrestling. If you look at it historically, it's more, I think that would be the one with the most influence. Yeah. You know, and it wasn't just Japan. It was like the whole, you know, I think that a lot of that came from, you know, tapes and then now internet, where young guys who are watching wrestling did not limit their viewership to one company and one style. And when you start adapting things from every style and you get this mix, that's kind of like what, you know, it's a lot of what a lot of the Japanese companies did earlier, where you had a lot of guys come in who studied all different types of style, and Lucha Libre was not this horrible bullshit that only happens in Mexico and all that, which it was stigmatized at and it doesn't count and all that. And it's not wrestling. You know, kind of like learning that you can blend it in, you know, and it is different, you know, and there is stuff that would work in Arena Mexico that doesn't exactly work, would not work in WWE. And there's stuff in WWE, they went down there, that would not work to an Arena Mexico audience, because they're just, they're completely different flows and styles and psychologies, really.
We have one more Hall of Fame question for you, Dave, because we love these conversations about the Hall of Fame, because it's so fascinating to discuss all these different elements and how candidates from those different elements kind of match up against each other. And this one comes from Adam Berger, asking kind of like about the Japan region specifically. There are very few male inductees that didn't headline in JWA, New Japan, or All Japan during their careers. But because a lot of the biggest stars are already in the Hall of Fame, how does this impact the region going forward? And does this potentially help influential headliners from smaller promotions like Hayabusa and Shima?
I think that it helps them now, because right now, when I look at the ballot, they're pretty much two of the stronger candidates. So yeah, you know, it's one of those things, whether it's Japan, United States, Mexico, if you're not in the major promotions, it's very, very difficult, maybe even impossible, you know, to get through, because, you know, I mean, there's, again, there are, I mean, I guess you could say Ultimo Dragon, but he, you know, Ultimo Dragon was in big companies at times and things like that. But there's very few of the guys who were not like All Japan, New Japan headliners that, you know, are going to get in. And in the United States, nobody's still gotten in from Ring of Honor. You know, nobody's gotten in from TNA exclusively. AJ Styles, it was New Japan and WWE that got him in. TNA helped, but nobody's gotten in specifically based on that. And nobody got in from ECW. That may change in time. You know, but AEW is a much higher profile than ECW. I think people from AEW will eventually be getting in, although they haven't yet. But I mean, as far as guys, who with Ring of Honor, I mean, the Briscoes were the best case scenario, and I don't know that they'll get in or not. You know, it doesn't look promising based on year one, because I thought year one would be the year with the sympathy and everything like that. So, and the uniqueness of Jay passing away. But yeah, I mean, we haven't had that. We haven't had anyone from exclusively Dragon Gate get in. You know, Shingo's not in. He probably will. But we both know that, or we all three of us know that without the New Japan run, he probably wouldn't, even though he's been an incredible, incredible wrestler for, you know, 15 plus years.
In the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, but with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club Slab Pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show, and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it and look, it's going to be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably going to get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, ah, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing, you know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You can display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading, so you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, sending these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling required. Keyless entry, no more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio, and then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally, and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They're on standby for you 24/7, so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy Video Lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived. And really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys, reach in my pocket, or wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy Video Lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition, 1 second. Door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is E-U-F-Y Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, E-U-F-Y Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
We got a question here from Gerard, who asks, do you think it's inevitable that weekly wrestling TV in North America is going to be on streaming? And if so, do you expect it will make it more difficult to attract new fans? And if they do go down that route, how could companies attract new fans under those circumstances?
Yeah, it'll be harder to attract new fans that way, even though everybody's on streaming and everything like that. It's going to be so much more important for word of mouth than accidental. Hey, we're just flipping around and we're seeing it. So word of mouth will become way, way, way more important in time. And that'll be what attracts new fans. But I mean, like the whole thing is like the same way most people get in, which is someone who they know or something like that, is a fan and just, hey, watch this and you like it. You know, that'll still exist with streaming, but it does change the game. But in time, you know, like the audience for a big show on streaming, I don't know if it'll be as big as television, because there's so many options, but at the same time, it'll be enough, I think, to be marketable for the shows. I think, it's unproven, but I think in time, you know, I guess I see it with UFC, but UFC obviously is on television, but so much of their content is now streaming. And while the television shows draw many, many, many more viewers than the streaming shows, the fact is they went all streaming for their pay-per-views and, you know, did okay. So it's, you know, and each year as the generational shifts continue, you know, streaming is going to be more, it's already is more and more important, but still, you know, it's like, you know, we see the Thursday football numbers compared to everybody else's football numbers. And while the Thursday football numbers are still very, very big, they're pale compared to Sunday and Monday.
I'm very interested to kind of see how that goes. And this next question comes from Stacy, Dave, and being from Minnesota, like my mom actually went to high school with Mr. Perfect and the Hennigs.
So Tom Zink too. And, who else? Nord and Darso. I think a bunch of those guys went to the same high school, right?
Yeah. But both my parents went to that same high school.
Yeah. So. Brady Boone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's about the NWA and how Vince McMahon kind of infiltrated. And the two questions are, when Vince expanded nationally, is there a reason why he seemed to go after the AWA and Vern Gagne first? And then also along that same line, did he ever consider doing a WrestleMania at the Metrodome? And with Hogan and Andre having been huge attractions for the AWA?
I know that I'm going to guess it came up, but I mean, as far as like Vince definitely had, you know, beating Vern, was more personal to Vince than maybe some of the other promoters. So yeah, he did go, but also, you know, a lot of the AWA guys and people that worked there were all close. And when some of them went and they could see the sinking ship that the AWA was, and it was very clear it was, you know, they asked their friends, hey, get me in there. You know what I mean? So it was a combination, you know, like, you know, Hogan, you know, it's like, hey, Hulk, you know, get me in, you know, please. And, you know, so it was kind of that, but Vince definitely had it in for Vern. You know, I think that was one that he really personally wanted. You know, he made him an offer, Vern laughed it off. And, you know, so Vince had to prove himself and, you know, Vern ended up, you know, his company ended up going down.
Was that the most personal scalp for Vince? From those early territory days?
I think so. I don't think it was quite as personal with Crockett. It probably would have been with Ole, but Ole was out of the picture by, you know, as far as a major force by early 85. I think Ole would have been more, you know, Eddie Graham probably was not going to be personal, you know, and wasn't, because, you know, his father and Eddie Graham, you know, had a relationship. Stu Hart wasn't really personal. I think Vern was the most personal, yeah.
I'm combining two questions here from Andrew and Waffles on Air, their given name, I'm sure, about the current status of AEW. Do you think they're doing better, worse, or about the same as you thought they would be right now at this point in their history? And how has your perception of Tony Khan's ability to run a wrestling company changed since their launch?
Okay, so revenue-wise... probably stronger than I expected they would be at this stage of the game. Attendance wise, I would say today slightly in the range, maybe slightly below, but in the range. Pay-per-view well up. As far as Tony Khan, look, I expected that there would be inexperience issues that would come to the fore, and there were. There's been frustrations. It's a learning experience. He was dealt a lot of hands. He's been dealt a lot of really weird hands. You know, I mean, who knew the pandemic was coming? The fact they survived the pandemic, you know, was a real credit. Some of the handling of guys, there's certainly the thing of, you know, like, compared to like the WWE people who, you know, the talent, I don't think, I mean, talent, the top talent ran over Vince too, you know, I mean, they really did, but not, I don't think it was at this level. And, you know, I think that, you know, everything was, I think, actually doing pretty good. And then the Punk thing kind of like, from the day that, Cabana got banished, and then especially the scrum where he's sitting there and Punk is doing all this and he doesn't shut it down and he doesn't fight for his guys. I think that was a real turning point. Afterwards, I think he could have turned it back around, but he didn't. And a lot of guys in his company, I think, got hurt because of the handling of that entire thing from start to finish. You know, that's one that they, you know, like Vince had a lot of issues and Vince played favorites and all that, but he never had the lingering issue where, you know, like there were plenty of massive fights in the WWE dressing room and guys were not fired for them. Of course it was different here and everything like that too, but they were over and done with, you know, and there might be some bitterness with the participants, but it didn't just take up the promotion, so to speak, take over the promotion as it did. So, I mean, his handling of that, you know, that, you know, it hurt the company without a doubt. I mean, there's been pluses and there's been minuses. You know, his willing to spend a lot, you know, is interesting, you know, especially like on music rights and things like that. You know, banking for the future. You know, we've never really had a wrestling promoter who banked so much on the future in the sense of future TV rights, you know, and going with that. And again, we're not at a point where we know if it's going to work out or not financially as far as profit loss goes. We're still not there yet. And the value of the brand right now doesn't necessarily mean that'll be the value of the brand in 5 years. It may be way, way up. It may be way, way down. You know, it's different. You know, I mean, he came in as someone who was in the, you know, he's been in many businesses, but one of the businesses he's been in is the football business. And he kind of had the mentality of how you run a football franchise business-wise. I'm not talking about personnel-wise, business-wise. And that is a completely different mentality from anyone who has ever gotten into the wrestling business pretty much ever. They're all about Friday's gate or next week's pay-per-view or, you know, whatever, and maximizing profits as much as you can and screwing the boys and things like that. That's always been what wrestling has been about. And he's gone differently. He's gone like more of a football team owner thing. So it's kind of changed and people kind of judge him sometimes as a wrestling owner. But the football owner thing may be more valid based on every other sport, which is, you know, it's about building up your thing and getting TV rights. And I mean, the next TV deal is going to be gigantic because it's the one where it's like, okay, was he a success or was he a failure? Right now, it looks like, you know, while people want to paint him as a failure, overall, I would say he's been a pretty great success, but it's not 100% until he gets that next TV deal and the streaming deal. And they're basically solidified in what they're doing right now. We're still waiting and waiting. We're waiting for the streaming deal. We're waiting for the TV deal. And we don't know, you know, and you know, yes. And the traditional metric as far as attendance is going down and they have to deal with that one. They just have to deal with that one.
How much of the current discontent backstage do you think can be directly traced to the aftermath of that All Out brawl and the whole situation with CM Punk, specifically the press conference, I think more than the brawl?
There's so many factors because again, like the stuff with talent, with a large roster of good talented people who aren't getting the TV time, they were frustrated. There were people frustrated before any of that happened. So that stuff, I don't think was greatly affected by that. But for some people, you know, that thing, as far as the perception of Tony, yes, that certainly has affected that in a lot with a lot of people. Sure.
Dave, I want to circle back to the Hall of Fame because the inclusion of the Von Erichs generated a question for a good friend of the show, South Dakota Jones, asking specifically about other potential groups and stables being added in there, including the NWO and Four Horsemen, and whether that would be a potential option. And if you were to do that, would you induct the group as kind of just a construct? Or would you be putting on the ballot like NWO would be Hogan, Nash, and Scott Hall? Or would it just be kind of what the group itself was?
Yeah, I don't really like the idea of the group thing unless they regularly wrestled as a group. Like a tag team that wrestles regularly as a tag team, I would put them on the ballot as a tag team. If it's two guys like Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage who had some tag team matches and they were very influential, I would never put them in as a tag team, and I don't have to because they're both in already. But I'm not like if the Four Horsemen constantly for years did nothing but eight man tags or did the majority eight man tags, I would put them in. You know, they were the top heel group. I wouldn't put Gary Hart's Army in Florida in or something like that, or NWO. You know, I mean, I would put Hall and Nash, and you could put Hogan, Hall and Nash as a threesome, but you know, Hogan was mostly doing singles. So I don't really like the idea of the group because then it becomes, you know, it becomes the whole thing. NWO, does Brian Adams get in? You know what I mean? It's like, then it's kind of silly. So I don't like I said, I don't like the ideas of the group. The Von Erichs were close. They did a lot of, you know, they did a lot of singles matches, but they did high profile trios matches, and they were more of a, I don't know. I think that they were more of a tag team in a lot of ways, held tag team championships and things like that, and trios championships when the trios championships meant something. So I felt better about putting them or the Freebirds in when it's a unit like that with Hall and Nash. You know, Hall and Nash are on the ballot. You know, the Horsemen, Tully and Arn are on the ballot. Tully and Arn, you know, Rick traveled with them and he did promos with them, but he didn't do a lot of six-man tags and eight-man tags with them.
So kind of a follow-up here, Dave, because we talked about Super Dragon earlier as far as like an influence case. Would you be open to the idea of adding it like stables for a specific influence case? It would be a little bit of a different construct, whereas it wouldn't be like, hey, you're inducting them because of they were wrestling together. But the NWO has a tremendous influence case on the world of professional wrestling. You could argue
that
in a different vein, Bullet Club does too. Would that be something that you would consider down the line?
I'd consider it. But, you know, Bullet Club's another one. It's just like now, you know, I mean, if you're a star in Bullet Club, it's one thing, but just Bullet Club in general, you know, even though, yeah, they sold a lot of merchandise and they were big in Japan and even for a time in the United States and NWO, obviously, look, you know, I mean, the NWO t-shirt, you know, should we do t-shirt Hall of Fame? You know, this NWO and Austin 316, you know, I mean, they sold a ton of t-shirts. That's for sure.
Next follow-up question is from Ryan Norcross, I believe. The Confederate Wrestling Alliance. I had not heard about this before his question. On January 5th, 1996, ran a pay-per-view entitled Bodyguards versus Bandits.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Which consisted of one show. Did you watch it? Do you know how many buys it got? What was the deal with that?
It got, I don't remember the number of buys. It was incredibly small. I did watch it. Yeah, it was the weakest pay-per-view or one of the weakest pay-per-views I ever saw. Yeah.
Is that the lowest bought pay-per-view that you're aware of?
I don't know, because like some of the ones now, I mean, there are pay-per-views that are being bought by, you know, a couple hundred people, you know, some of the recent ones, you know, like before Billy Corgan took the NWO stuff off TV pay-per-view. I mean, it had very, very, very low numbers on television. I mean, they may have done a little bit better streaming. Some of the Impact, you know, numbers were very, very, very low too. I don't think they'd been as low as that one though. That one, you know, it had no TV backup. Yeah, I don't think that one did, you know, again. But there's been some very low. I mean, there have been under thousands, you know, out there, and that's pretty darn low.
Dave, this question comes from Daz Traction, and I find this interesting, especially because of how luchadors were used towards the back end of the 90s in American professional wrestling. And the question is, do you think that AAA could have been even more successful in America in 95 and onward and potentially have been that third promotion if it wasn't for the collapse of the peso? Because we know how great that One Worlds Collide show was in 94, and it's still viewed as kind of like a legendary pantheon show. Do you think that they could have been able to make a lot of inroads in America if it weren't for the peso?
I think the key would have been if they could have gotten the right television deal and then gotten enough backing for the production and everything. Yes. I believe that they could have been a viable, you know, niche company. Yeah. Yeah. The peso cost them a lot of their talent and as well. But I mean, they were successful in certain markets. And they would have been, you know, it's like they could have come to other markets and drawn pretty decently, but I don't know if it would have been financially successful. I think they needed the TV to take it to the next level. They were on Galavision, but Galavision had very limited exposure. If they were on something like put it this way, if there was a something like Univision is today, with the power of Univision today, and the AAA of 1993 got on there in prime time, like they were on Televisa, I think they would have been very, very successful running live shows in certain markets. It would have been hard because of the cultural differences, but I think in time those would have kind of worn down a little bit because, I do remember when I would go to the AAA shows, there were almost no non-Mexican fans there. Very, very few. As great as it was still one of those cultural things where if you were you either wouldn't know about it or you just wouldn't go. You know what I mean? It was specifically towards that end. Now you could bring, a Lucha Libre show and you'll have, a lot of people who are not Mexican go to the show. But it doesn't have the fervor that, because again, Lucha Libre culturally in Mexico right now is nothing compared to what it was, 30 years ago. It's so much smaller. People I don't think really realize how big it was. They used to have, legitimately like 25 shows a night in Mexico City alone. And there were, more shows in Mexico than anywhere in the world. Now that's not the case anymore. There's still a lot of shows, but it's from a cultural standpoint, Místico's big, but he's not as big as Perro Aguayo was. He had a run where he was actually, that short run where he was very, very big, but it's not like Perro Aguayo, where if Perro Aguayo came to California and there was a Lucha Libre show, he'd draw several thousand people. And I don't know that Místico headlining a show, just a local independent Lucha Libre show in California on his own is going to do that.
When I was putting out calls for questions for this, I got multiple comments about, Dave Meltzer doesn't know how to rate matches. One, do you, how tiring is that for you as a guy that, it seems like all this work you've done and like people just obsess over your match ratings? And two, do you wish you just gave Undertaker Michaels 5 stars so people would have shut up?
I don't even think about it because that would be kind of stupid to think about it. You know what I mean? It's decades ago. I almost did. I was right on the border, It's like this 4 3/4 is 5. And whenever I ask myself that, it's 4 3/4. 5's got to be like no doubt in my mind. Right. And I had a doubt. So there you go. And, there are reasons I had a doubt. A lot of people then had a doubt. I had two of the greatest wrestlers of all time, and I had already rated the match, who talked to me about the next day. And both of them had major qualms about the match. One of them basically said that we could never do a match like that because it would hurt the business because of the feeling of kicking out of so many finishers, which, I thought that was an old school viewpoint anyway. And the other one was, what thought process? Your turn, my turn, your turn, my turn. Which actually kind of was one of the things when I was watching, it's like, your turn, my turn, your turn, my turn. And it was a fantastic match. But traditionally when I do watch YouTube, your turn, my turn matches, I usually, you know, top them out at, you know, 4.5, maybe 4.75 if they're exceptional. You know what I mean? I mean, like for 5, you need something more unique to me. I mean, I may watch that, you know, I mean, it's probably unfair though, because when I watch older matches now, I always think that they're worse than I remember. You know, some people think, you know, if you watch it now, you'll revise it. And it's like, the odds are, I'll probably go like, I'll notice things wrong because from certain technical aspects, like, you know, body placement, body, you know, things like that. The guys are so much better and smoother today than they were in the past. And because of that, I notice people out of position so much more that I didn't notice when I was watching stuff in the 80s and 90s. And I'll watch, or, you know, I'm, again, like when I watch older matches that are, that I thought were 5 stars, I still watch them and I go like, yeah, it's a freaking great match. But I wouldn't, almost in rare occasions would I say, oh, that's a 5-star match today. Some of them, there are a few, but, you know, like, and mostly those are the All Japan matches, really, not the American matches. The American matches, it always feels like they were, you know, if I watch them now, it's like, yeah, that's really, really good. But God damn, you know, it's like, I see stuff this good on TV every week, you know, and, you know, so there, like I said, there's exceptions to that though, too.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel, Dave, that kind of how you walked us through that thought process is why you ended up breaking the 5-star scale, just because wrestling today in a lot of elements has gotten a lot better than it was 20 years ago?
Yes, for sure. Just like it always, you know, I mean, yeah, yeah. There's a level of thought put in the matches that's never been there before. This level of, you know, yeah, I mean, I guess thought, you know, just this, you know, the mental aspect of the match is like before, guys, you know, and it's like, look, it's more power to him, you know, Ric Flair going in the ring and not knowing anything that he's going to do, except he's going to do his spots and he tells you when he feels like it's time to do the spot and everything like that. And you know what I mean? It's very different from people sitting there going like, let's do, you know what I mean? Like examining it and going into detail, but it makes for a more depth for the product. You know, people don't see it, but I mean, again, like guys work on their big matches. Guys work so much harder mentally on their big matches now than they did before. And it shows, and some people don't want to see it, but it's just, that's, I mean, I just remember like Dick Byer, you know, like, I was like Dick Byer story, you know, there was, somebody had done a thing and it was some Dick Byer match and they're going through all these details of this is why Dick did this and this is why Dick did that and everything. And I showed it to Dick Byer and Dick Byer just starts laughing and he just goes like, I didn't think about any of that stuff. I just went in the ring and just kind of felt like, what should I do at this moment? And that's what I did. Because I didn't, you know, it's like, he did this, this is why he did this, and this is why he did this. And he just started laughing about it. It's like, I didn't think that deeply. I just went out there and wrestled.
Do you think that the level of in-ring, you know, how much it's improved from, let's just say 20 years ago to today, do you think that's a bigger step up than, like, let's just say 75 to 95?
75 to 95 was a lot too. I think it's accelerated in the last several years due to YouTube, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And people watching so many great matches and trying to emulate what they've learned from those matches from all over the world, you know, whereas before, you know, you learned from Matt, you know, if you were a wrestler, you learned from matches in your territory. And if you went from territory to territory in other territories, but not necessarily all over the world, you know, and also, you know, you are taught this is how wrestling is. And now I think there's more of an open-mindedness of wrestling can be whatever you want it to be if it works. And if it doesn't work, then you drop it. But there's no, I think that the lessening of hard and fast rules that you were taught is also an aspect of it, which is also one of the reasons why some people, you know, hate modern wrestling for that very reason, because they want the wrestling that they grew up with and they want it to always stay the same. But what they forget is that it was never that case. Now it's moving faster now because of what I told you. Mm-hmm. But I remember in the late 80s, I got a bunch of tapes of great wrestling from the 70s. And it was just like, I was so disappointed in some ways because it didn't measure up to the late 80s with a few exceptions. It was like, it just wasn't as good. And it's the same thing. And, you know, they were, but they were wrestling for a different audience that wanted a different thing. And so it, in every generation, it always gets faster. It always gets faster. That's just the evolution. I think that's probably the same way in movies and music and many other genres, is that it's, you know, faster, you know, lower attention span, whatever. I mean, it's just, you need, you know, you can't do the slow stuff because people don't have the patience for it. And, you know, and the audience has seen so much, you know, so it's harder. It's really hard on these guys though, because we've gotten in a situation where, you know, these guys, these incredible matches are normal. And that's, you know, it's a good thing, but it's a sad thing too, because like there are matches on TV every single week that if they were on TV in the 80s, we'd be talking about them for months and people would remember for 20 years. And these matches are being forgotten 3 days later because there's so many of them. You know, and to have a standout match now, you know, even the greatest standout match now, you get another one a month later or a week later. It's you know, it's not like the past, you know, which is harder. It is much harder on the talent, and you know, and it leads to people trying to stand out. In some ways, when you stand out, you get more dangerous, and that's not necessarily a good thing. And it's often not a good thing, you know.
Dave, I want to go here. Question from No has to do with the new WWE and UFC conglomerate. Ever since they merged in with Endeavor, AEW has done a lot of cross promotional stuff. They just did the street fight with the Sega game, and they've done a lot of that kind of promotional stuff. But this question is, do you think that we might see more WWE and UFC crossover, including potentially using the Octagon for cage matches, kind of like they had a Riddle Rollins match with Cormier as the ref? Do you think that we might be seeing some cross promotion in those terms with WWE and UFC?
Possible, but I think it's more publicizing each other, which I actually haven't seen. Like I thought that we would see on WWE pay-per-views, you know, ads or appearances by UFC guys pushing their pay-per-view. And we haven't seen that. And on UFC pay-per-views, we have not seen WWE guys, you know, promoting their stuff. But that was the stuff that I was expecting, that kind of cross promotion. The WWE doing it and, you know, using an Octagon as far as for a match, because the trademark issue, you know, wouldn't be there anymore. Yeah, I could see that for sure. You know, more from the WWE standpoint than the UFC standpoint. I don't see UFC copying much about WWE at all. Even the stuff WWE does well that they could incorporate. I think they like being what they are. You know what I mean? They've never gone the pride route of the big spectacle in that way. They've been it's just what they haven't done.
Do you think the lack of promotion on both sides is a Peacock ESPN Plus thing?
I don't know. I don't think so. I just think that it's just something that they, you know, I don't know why they haven't done it. I thought that it was a given. And they've talked about it. You know, they talked about that exact thing that I'm bringing up.
Didn't they talk about doing like a weekend of events? Like you get a WWE pay-per-view and UFC pay-per-view, same weekend, same city?
Absolutely. For overseas, you know, more than, but trying to get cities to pay lots and lots of money to them. And we'll give you, you know, like a Friday night WWE pay-per-view and a Saturday night UFC pay-per-view. And we'll bring all these tourists in, and it's two sets of tourists that are going to be coming in because there's, you know, there's a crossover audience, but it's, you know, it just makes the weekend bigger in your market. Mm-hmm. And, more tourists might go, hey, you know what, we'll go to this and we'll also get this, you know, even though we're maybe coming primarily for this, or we're coming in for UFC, but WWE's got a big show. Let's tune in, you know, let's come in with the idea of, you know, having more tourists. Cause that's what these rights fees are all about, you know, tourism. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dave, you know, I know that you're coming up on your out, so just let us know. We need to let you go. I got one more question I do want to ask you first, though, if that's okay. It's from Nicholas, and it's about Tony Khan and the relationship with Warner Brothers Discovery. Do you think that he's too loyal to David Zaslav? He points out, like, how much Warner Brothers Discovery is cutting costs right now and how David Zaslav seems extremely cutthroat. And is it possible that Warner Brothers WBD owns part of AEW?
I think it's very possible, yeah. Yeah, no one's proven it or anything like that, but... you know, I mean, I asked Tony directly and he didn't deny it, but he wasn't going to confirm it, but he didn't deny it. He just said that he had 100% of the voting stock, which I'm sure he does. But I mean, as far as like, were they cut in from the beginning? Or, you know, I mean, they had like WBD had, or it was just Warner Brothers then, but you know, Warner Brothers had, Warner Media had a lot of leverage on them in that first television deal because they were a complete unknown who, if they did not get the television deal, they would have never gotten off the ground. So they had leverage to get something. Whether they got that, I don't know. You know, no one has proven it, but he didn't deny it. Like, I thought that when I asked that question, if he said no, I would believe, okay, it's no. When he said, I have 100% voting stock, I took that to, yeah, they have an interest. Yeah.
Would that be something that they'd have to disclose, Warner Brothers Discovery, as far as being a publicly owned company?
I don't know. They haven't disclosed it.
Right. Yeah.
I don't, I think that I've people have asked that, and I think that it'd be, for whatever reason, you know, but whatever. Yeah, no. I've been told that they wouldn't necessarily have to, but you know, that which just adds to the mystery, I guess.
And one more thing I want to bring up, and then we'll let you go, because I know that you, I really appreciate the time you've given us already. East Coast Johnny said that you mentioned when you talked about going away from the print Observer, and last week, that was the last print edition, is that correct? Or is it
this coming? The one I'm working on is actually the last one.
Okay, cool. So he said that you mentioned that you wanted to pivot to doing more real-time reporting during the week. How do you envision that working?
Just less time on certain aspects that I do, you know, as far as, TV reviews, and more just, you know, contacting people and stuff. I mean, I'd still do it. I don't think it's going to marketably change, but I'm, you know, that's something that interests me more than writing TV reports. So, I may do less TV reports and more stories. That's kind of been my goal. Yeah. You know, spend my time doing that, but it's not going to, like, again, it's like when I have a story, I get the story done. You know what I mean? It's like, I contact the people I need to contact and everything like that. I always make time for that. So I don't know that it's going to change markedly. I always mess that up.
Yeah. As somebody who does kind of the real time stuff, it's fun. I like it. Dave, as Fred mentioned earlier, we greatly appreciate your time and shedding some light on a lot of these really interesting topics. I know you have a lot of cool stuff going on at the Observer, and most of our audience probably already knows these answers, but where can they find you, and what stuff do you have coming down the pipeline that everybody can be really excited about?
Well, got all kinds of books at Amazon.com, which are Observer compilation books for different years. And, you know, I go through them from time to time, and they fascinate me because, again, you know, I'm here and I don't remember every single thing that happened 30 years ago when I read it. It's actually quite fascinating to me. But I mean, as far as the Weekly Observer, you know, www.wrestlingobserver.com. And I do the podcast with Brian Alvarez and Garrett Gonzalez. The Garrett Gonzalez Show on Fridays most weeks is, my favorite, because we really don't do TV reviews and we just try to go in depth on the stories. But the Monday, Wednesday and weekend show with Brian, we go through the news first and then we do the TV reviews and talk about everything that's going on in wrestling. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. I like it a lot.
Dave, thank you so much again. And Tyler, are we going to do a normal show this week, or are we just going to skip the next?
I don't know. My birthday is on Thursday, so we'll have to talk about it.
All right. Sounds good. We'll post something on Twitter. Dave, thank you again. Really appreciate it. And thanks to everyone that sent in questions. Apologies if we didn't get to them. We did our best. And hope you all have a good week. Dave, have a great day.
Okay. Thanks very much.
My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines. And we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.